We're going to have a talk today from Ergo Fismes, to my right. Over the past 13 years, Ergo Fismes has created a body of work across theatre, songwriting, electronic music, collage, exhibitions, installations, opera, video, and radio plays. So like a really wide variety of contexts. And has constantly defied categorisation and been performed or broadcast all over the world. I really like that kind of sense of working across all media and kind of the interdisciplinarity of it. It kind of sums up, I suppose, a part of the ethos of the Media Arts course, working in multimedia. Places that have presented Ergo Fismes' work include BBC Six Music, BBC Radio 3, Resonance FM, Sonic Arts Network, the Royal Festival Hall, and the Tate Modern. Without further ado, I'm going to pass you over to Ergo. Thank you.
Very good. Right. Well, we'll try and have a picturesque beginning. Imagine, if you will, a big, almost endless landscape, and in that landscape, it's multicoloured, and there's millions and millions of different colours and tiny little fragments of things, and on the horizon we can see all of these things like a giant junkyard. And as you step closer to it, you start to realise that what this big junkyard is just piles and piles and piles of empty little plastic shells. And this is a place that I imagined making a radio play a couple of years ago called Boojum, which was kind of about how the internet affects artists' practice and how the internet affects us as human beings and how the internet will affect posterity and how the things that we're doing now are going to carry over into 100 years' time. I've started collecting 78 RPM records in the last few years, a little obsessively, because what fascinates me about them is two things. One is that the original object from 100 years ago is still there and still playable with a pin and a piece of string and a tin can, and we can, you know, with very simple technology, we can listen to this. But the our iPods and our mobile phones and pretty much everything that we're not giving a final physical form to, ultimately, I think, is as technology becomes obsolete, a lot of the stuff that's being generated now by people is going to start to disappear. So when I pictured this graveyard of empty shells, as it became known in my head, I pictured the idea of music. The music that was inside these boxes kind of is now disembodied and floating or nowhere. But surely all this stuff can't be nowhere, because something, if it's been in a place, has to exist in some way, or that seems to be one of the givens of the universe, that it's impossible to destroy anything entirely. And what I was thinking about that is that the things, because I've put a lot of music on the internet. I was kind of, when the internet first came about, it was obviously very, very exciting. This is kind of about 2001 or something like that, when I first started to really look at the internet and to use it. And back in the days of uploading an MP3 would take an hour to upload a 3 megabyte MP3. You would sit there watching it, and it would be very exciting as the little line would go, like, yes, how one MP3 is online. And since then, I kind of fell into the habit of making music and giving it away for free on the internet, because for a long time, and to an extent still now, it's one of the main ways that I've been able to reach an audience. But the problem with it is, and at the moment I'm in a very questionable relationship with the internet, because the problem seems to be that well, let's say put it in the context of writing something on Twitter or something like that. If you write something on Twitter, then, and you have, say you have 1,000 followers or something like that, you write something and the chances are that maybe one out of those 1,000 people are going to see it, because all those 1,000 people each follow 1,000 people, and it's disappears as quickly as it's arrived. So I think that the place where all the music that's theoretically floating about above this graveyard of empty boxes is I think of it as like a big abyss where everything goes. So all the tweets and all the MP3s and all of this stuff just disappears almost immediately. Almost. The internet was supposed to kind of give almost immortality to art, and also kind of to give this democratic opportunity to everybody to be able to make art and be an artist and reach an audience. But in reality, the system doesn't really seem to work because of this thing of the abyss. So if I release some free audio and post it up, then the only way it seems to make that reach an audience is just to post it again and again and again and again and again. But then the people who have seen it a few times then start to regard the person doing that as a spammer, so then unfollow, so then you start to hit not that person anymore. So I have kind of found that the world for people kind of, for want of a better phrase, wanting to make a living out of art or music, it seems to all be at a very strange point where we have these big systems like the music industry and the arts, but they don't call themselves the art world, the art industry, but it is the art industry and the music industry. And conventionally, education has been teaching people that the way to success is to sort of follow this straight line into the music industry or the art world and enter into these systems which are all sort of hierarchies and trying to climb ladders to, and then end up working in an art gallery and dressing as an estate agent, as they all do. And we don't want to dress as estate agents. It's a terrible idea. So what I've kind of fallen into is trying to operate outside of these industries because, well, A, they don't want me, and secondly, I don't want them. And I think an interesting way to think about these industries is that they are all attempting to, there's a lot of homogenization. So for example, I find it very strange that the majority of the world listens to one form of music, which is the pop song. And the pop song is an amazing development, a crystallization of hundreds and hundreds of years of practice and thought, and it's a crystallization of how to communicate a message in a very accessible way that, you know, what other form of communication is strong enough that, you know, you access it once and then it's like stuck in there for forever. But because that because this medium has been claimed by this industry, I think it hasn't really been permitted to blossom in the way that perhaps it could have done. And by that I mean in things like the subject matter of the pop song. When I release pop songs and when they chance to get reviewed, they're often written off as comedy songs, because it seems that if you write a song where the subject matter isn't "Oh baby, I want to love you tonight," then it's written off as comedy. Though this person must be trying to say something else, say something ironic or sarcastic by making a pop song about putting his socks on or something. But I think we should be able to make songs about all our experiences, and I think the industries, well, for a start, the music industry's only existed for nigh on, you know, not even 100 years. which is very, very young for something, but the people who run them obviously consider them immortal institutions, but it's clearly on the way out anyway. But the point I was trying to reach about that was that the approach that I've taken in trying to not be part of these industries is to try and work in mediums that that generally don't have a lot of presence in this country or in the world. So I work very heavily in radio production in Germany primarily, because in Germany they have this wonderful Hörspiel culture where they commission every week from all sorts of people radio plays where the format of radio is really tested and really explored and really experimented with. And as well as that, I do this thing which I term homemade operas. I'll stop talking at some point and play something. No. When I said the radio... Ah, now, yes, that was it. Going back to this idea of industries and kind of the idea of progress and technology, a big concern in the modern world, certainly for artists, seems to be this reliance and exploration of technologies. And I spend a lot of time writing arts funding applications and things, and I'm always kind of slightly tearing my hair out when one of... Now, well, the last few years, the priorities on funding applications tend to be how can you use contemporary technology? How can you integrate that into this? And I'm perplexed that this kind of idea is there, because it's unavoidable in the modern world, and we're all integrating this technology into our lives. So I think it's a more interesting question now to look at what we can do, not without it, but with it as being less of a central part of the practice, or just basically being a tool. And that was the point I was coming to. It was that with radio and with any medium in the last 100 years, really, because it's been such a rapid time of technological progress. I've been watching Stepstone's Son the last few weeks. Somebody very kindly got me. It was a birthday present. And when I was a child, I used to see it on the television, and always in colour. The last two series of Stepstone's Son are in colour, but all the sort of eight series before that are in black and white. And television, when I was a kid, never showed the black and white episodes, because black and white was considered obsolete by then, so they wouldn't show the black and white episodes. So there's a whole era of a program that's not shown because it's considered technologically obsolete. And I think I've become very interested by the idea of if we take an alternative, that if we take the progression of the 20th century and then imagine, say, that electrical technology stops developing as fast around 1930 or something, and then rock and roll would never quite happen in the same way, and certainly electronic music wouldn't have happened. So I like to imagine how would music have progressed if technology hadn't gone at the rate it had, and what would have happened to radio certainly in this country if television hadn't come along. Because radio was the thing that people sat around to do instead of sitting around watching The X Factor, they'd all gather around the wireless and sit and listen to that. So
I find it very strange
that radio isn't considered like the realm of like a film director or something like this. Because More than film and more than television, radio offers the opportunity to do anything and go anywhere and imagine any scenario possible without huge budgets, without the need to realize something in three dimensions in front of you. So on in radio, Spike Milligan in The Goon Show in the 1950s used to do things like two people, well, a group of people trying to escape from prison, and they all climb on each other's shoulders, and then once they haven't reached the top window, the person from the bottom comes and climbs up over the top of all them. So it's possible with radio just to completely defy the laws of physics like this in a way that would make no sense. And I think radio is a, because of this, because television came along, radio hasn't in this country been allowed to sort of thrive and blossom into what it could have been. And this is also, with the other word, the other kind of main activity that I do now is opera. But not necessarily opera in the sense of big opera houses and prima donnas and tiaras and all this. But I was talking with someone in London not long ago who's an opera director, and he was saying that he thinks that opera has this opportunity now to completely break free of all of these shackles. Because what opera actually means is the work. And with, well, the kind of operas I make is a mixture of digital technology, projections, animation, shadow puppetry, and they're all cheap and nasty because I'm good at getting rejected for funding. But what being rejected for funding has done is enabled me to just have to think about stuff in different ways, and to think about stage productions in the same way that you think about radio. So if you want a you know, somebody to walk across stage, and then but then there to be a bloody murder or something like this, but you don't have the money for lots of stage blood and things, then have him walk off the stage and then come back on behind as a little shadow puppet version, and then have the another shadow puppet hitting him on the head and the animation exploding with blood behind him. So using all the different possible things that we have at our disposal now to tell stories and to communicate messages. And I think what I find particularly interesting about that is the whole idea of suspension of disbelief, and that we've been, again, it's to do with the industries. We've all been led into kind of accepting one way of looking at how stories can be told and how characters can be communicated, which is, in terms of cinema and in terms of the majority of television that tells a story, okay, we're sat and we're watching a very realistic story, and we believe in these people entirely, and it's all shot on location against real backgrounds and all this kind of thing, and all probably cost a fortune to make, which seems strange to me, because you can tell well, with unrealism, because this whole realism thing, again, it's only about 100 years old, and with unrealism you can tell any story that you want, again, with and it can be just as moving to an audience in on an emotional level, if not more moving. But it also puts the audience's imagination into play, and audiences very quickly accept this way of storytelling as well. So I should probably play something. I want to play you a sequence of a piece called Gargantua. Which is on the YouTube if anybody would like to catch up on the rest of it later, although it's a bit...
I just think it's really interesting that I didn't actually know Ogre was going to talk about that, but that he's just been talking about it, like things like these old records, vinyl records, that and the kind of obsolescence of them. And I just wanted to point out that ties in really, really closely with some of the things I've asked you to write about in the Media Archaeology essay. It's absolutely, you know, it's a really great. Thank you very much. Should do that. So, yeah, like this idea of where does media go, what happens to it, and what and this whole archive, and just being down at the southwest and covering that kind of, and seeing what was current media, now old media. It's a very kind of interesting phenomenon.
Right. So I'm going to play you a thing from a stage production that we did in March called Gargantua. It's based on a book written in medieval times by Francois Rabelais. And the book is kind of almost like a very funny encyclopedia of almost everything in the world at that time. It's almost the book is almost like the equivalent of the internet for the medieval world. It's full of ridiculous long lists of all kinds of things and word plays, and it's kind of like modernist writing made in the medieval times. And this production took the central character of Gargantua from the book. Gargantua is a giant baby. And I used that as a starting point to make a piece that was supposed to reflect on the internet as it is now, as compared to Rabelais' internet in the book, and the idea of the too much information overload. Also, and another subject that I'm very interested in is the kind of fragility of truth now, because truth. I mean, obviously, it's a very dodgy word, but the internet and the kind of way, I think it's got something to do with the sort of modern society of idea of always making sure that nobody's offended and things like that, that's led to the advent of things like Holocaust deniers, and I'm not going to talk about the Holocaust for too long because I do rattle on about it, but the fact that people who publicly deny that the Holocaust ever happened, and the Holocaust is only 60 years ago or something, and they're given the time of day and given the column inches and things like that, and then books like the Da Vinci Code that come out and with things that purport to be true but obviously aren't, and the writer knows they aren't, but people kind of go, oh yeah, this is true. Leonardo da Vinci hid a picture of Mary Magdalene inside the Last Supper and so on. And this piece is about the kind of the fragility of truth and the information overload and the internet and medievalism and Rabelais and detective stories I'll shush about it and play a bit. I'm going to play about a 6-minute extract, I think, that begins with a dream sequence. The two detectives who are looking for the giant King Gargantua who's disappeared decide that the best thing they could do to try and find this king is to fill up one of their opium pipes and see where the dreams will take them. And so what you're about to see is the opium dream sequence from Gargantua. It's made using the kind of things I was talking about, projections and puppetry and giant heads and cheap and, well, again, part of the point of Gargantua was to kind of make something that looked very big and sort of audacious but on pretty much zero money, and to tour it on zero money. And we had an adventure in around the country last March doing this terrible thing. And now it is a dead show as well, because I like to also, if we play a show that's a tour like this, I kind of like the tour itself to be part of the actual piece, and then the show itself is kind of changing and shifting every night, and then by the we never get enough time for rehearsal beforehand, so then by the end of the tours the show's always kind of pretty much ready to show to people by the end of it, but then we don't do them again because that kind of time's gone. So I'll play a little bit of Drugged Up Detectives.
Sometimes in opium dreams we find the best that waking life refuses to reveal.
Let's smoke. Oh wait, there needs a hearty meal. Perhaps by then our massive heads will be clearer, and to the solution of our mission we will grow.
Made using, it brings us quite neatly onto the next thing I wanted to talk about, actually, which is a very pleasant coincidence. It uses kind of as many techniques as we either could use or had to use. So in there's obviously sampling of found video collage, there's like the Orson Welles footage and the Wizard of Oz, and goodness knows what else is in there. I think Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is in there, but then that's coupled with original footage and animations, and then the sound is made from a mixture of samples and live instruments and electronic elements. And what I wanted to come to was this idea that a friend of mine, a German composer called Vernon Lenoir, mentioned to me years and years ago, describing the potential that we have now for something that he terms music without limits. And it can be extended to an extent into imagery, but not quite to the same extent. The thing that I find very exciting about computer music is the fact that not so long ago, composers would, like the BBC Radiophonic Workshop would have to, if they wanted a tape loop that would, loop and last a particular amount of time, they'd have to have tape loops that would take days and days to make and go down the corridor and through into different rooms just to make kind of 40 seconds of audio material. But when I started making music when I was very young, initially with tapes, and then like kind of just tape to tape, and then started notating when I decided in my teenage years that I wanted to be an opera composer, and something went wrong along the way, as you can see. And then I kind of went away from music and composition for a few years, and ended up at about the age of 21 back in my mum and dad's house with nowhere else to go. And in that time, computer technology had really accelerated, and suddenly you had these softwares with this idea of non-destructive editing, where you can cut something, then if it goes wrong you can press undo and change it, and you can copy it as many times and then vary that sound as many times as you want. So the composition can become like painting, or like imagine you could build a collage from a physical material, but then if you stick this piece of paper on, you can also stretch this bit of paper as long as you want, or you can make that bit of paper stick out, or you can turn the picture of the dog into the picture of the cat. With digital music, I've always been fascinated by this idea of making an entire large project only using one sound as the basis of it, because it's possible to take like a one sound or a hit on a desk or whatever, and in the digital environment, copy, and then pitch shift and make new melodies. You can look at it visually as a waveform and change the shape of the wave, so ultimately you can make one sound into anything that you want it to be, again and again and again and again. Which is kind of easy to take for granted now because it's there, but it's also surprising kind of how much music made on computers still sounds like music that's not made on computers. I think there's this tendency in human nature where if we have something that's kind of alarmingly versatile, we tend sort of quickly to go back to kind of the very safe parameters and make this very versatile thing very kind of safe. But the thing that fascinates me particularly with computer music is this idea that it can do, it's a cliche, but it can do more than what a pair of hands can do, or can do very differently to what a pair of hands can do. And what I mean by this very different idea is that if you have all of your blocks of sound recordings here, This one is somebody playing trombone. This is you strangling the cat, and this is me strangling my cat. And I'm really fascinated by the idea that you can take a piece of this and a piece of this and just sort of try throwing them together like this, and then you are thrown a sort of rhythmic and melodic surprises at every turn. And this idea of collaborating with the computer rather than kind of trying to bend the computer to your will, so that new shapes and forms can come out of this kind of idea. I made a radio program a few years ago called the Time Travel Musical Bazaar, where a friend of mine and me, we took a number of old record players and lots of old records from junk shops, but without listening to them in the first place, I might try and look for some of this next actually, without listening to the records in the first place and testing what was on them, just turning the recorder on and kind of putting the records on and then gradually trying to make sense and order out of this chaos. So it's a way of making music that's a little bit like having like one of those computer games where rocks are being thrown at you and you have to zap the rocks, but instead you're kind of grabbing the rocks and just trying to put it on top of that one, and but then 2 seconds later another rock has come, and so it's like endurance composition in a way. And that was what kind of led me to this thought of this thought of using the computer to sort of tell us things that we wouldn't have thought of otherwise, and kind of transforming something recognizable into something unfamiliar or something very, very different. So I think what I'll do is I'll put on a piece I made a long time ago, because I used to work very closely with computer manipulation, very fine, very, very close up. But now I'm more interested in this idea of transformation when it happens naturally. I want to start releasing a series of records which are 7 inches of 1920s pop music. But when the Internet Archive first came about, and if you don't know the Internet Archive, then you should go on it, because it's a huge wealth of public domain material that can be used from the 1950s onwards in audio and video. Yes, that's what I was talking about. On the Internet Archive, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of 1920s British dance band music. And every now and then, you get one where someone in the early days of the internet has got one of these pieces of computer noise reduction software, and they've thought, I've got a really good idea, I'm going to take all the hiss and all the crackles and all the pops of this record, and I'm going to put it on the internetarchive.org, and everybody's going to be really, really grateful for that. But then once the hisses and pops and clicks are removed, what remains is kind of like this underwater strangeness, like this, which the person who's put it on has gone, this hasn't got any hisses and pops, but it hasn't really got anything else either. But what I want to do is press these very, very badly encoded versions of 1920s pop songs on back sort of onto record. So the song has started as a 78 RPM record nearly 100 years ago, and then gone through this transformation on the internet that somebody at some point thought was a good idea, and then it's then become another object, but in the format closer to the one that it started with 100 years ago, but it's ceased to be the piece of music it was at all, and that's only kind of by one person's ill-informed idea about trying to make it sound better. But what I will do is play you a section of a piece called Thousand Year Mix, which is from about 2005, And the idea was that at the end of the 20th century and all the massive technological and scientific developments, we were all kind of left sort of spinning around, delirious, not knowing kind of how things can develop past this kind of optimum sort of end of the 20th century point. So the idea of Thousand Year Mix was to take sounds from the past 1,000 years, and they were grouped according to the first one was about tonality, and the second one was about technology and machines, and the third one was about the process of collage, and I can't remember what the other ones were about, but I'll play you a little bit of that, because this was made with this technique of constant transformation of tiny little sounds, and because it seems that there's two kinds of collage. There's kind of big slab collage where you put you know, two things next to each other, which is what I'm more interested in now. But this kind of collage in this 1,000-year mix piece is the kind of collage where you would take, well, like say you, if you're doing it with paper, you'd take tiny little bits of paper and piece them together like this. But because it's made in this computer music environment, it's possible to take those bits of paper and change the colour of them and stretch them and, you know, turn a square into a circle and all this kind of thing. So I've put in a little bit of 1,000-year mix. There we are. Now, which one should we have? A bit of part five. So, this is made using. In fact, no, I'm going to put a bit of part one on. This is the one about tonality and about the idea of the conventional Western musical scale of like doo 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 doo. And it's kind of playing games with that. So, I'll play maybe 5 minutes of this or something.
Why was it called 1,000 Minutes?
Because the idea was just to, at the end of a millennium, to look, because we don't really know hardly anything about the millennium before that, and this millennium is a millennium of the printing press and technology occurring and the way that it did. So it sounds kind of as far as I could go in trying to get a good cross-section of sounds culturally from across 1,000 years. Probably enough of that. I think I'd like to play you a piece now from last year, the year before, and then just talk a little bit more about sound in relation to the computer and this subject of how of collaborating with the computer and the computer throwing rhythmic and melodic surprises that the human brain couldn't think of. So bear with me whilst I scroll up this immense bloody page.
I was also interested to, I wanted to ask a question earlier on when you were talking about use of samples and appropriated materials,
mm-hmm.
sampling film, sampling sound, and the fact that the computer allows you to do all these things, like it allows this really like a wide open set of possibilities.
Mm.
And yet, actually, the experience we have more often of computer music is of something that's, and also of sample music,
mm.
is of material being quite derivative,
yeah.
and formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
And you managed not to seem derivative or formulaic,
yeah.
in your work, and that, so I just wondered about, you know, you were talking I wondered how that happens. It's about, maybe it's to do with what you're talking about, like your perspective on what a computer can do and what you're expecting it to do for you.
Yeah.
But then, are there some sort of strategies that you use particularly that, you know, that stop you from wanting to repeat things around lots of times? Or
It's kind of dependent on what the piece is. And like for my own personal taste, I tend to like things that repeat and go round and round and round and round. But then for my own productions, I've not done so. It seems to be very capable of doing it. I think it's mainly to do with that, because I've never had a kind of like regular or core audience, it's led me to, when I am working on something new, to kind of want to sort of play with the possibilities and explore kind of these the kind of interesting ways that things can clash off each other and complement each other. And this thing about when people get amazed, I put that music with that film and that bit went with that and it was amazing that works with that. But I think the digital environment, one of the things that makes it interesting is you know how easy it is to sort of try one thing and it not be kind of fixed. So even just on the level of trying, you know, laying lots of different pieces of music over a load of over the same clip of film and watching those different juxtapositions, the computer music environment is this grid that's very it's a very regimented grid, and people tend to look at that grid and see that the pages divided into beats and bars and all this. So the first thing a lot of people tend to do, I think, is look, well, obviously this needs to really fit into this grid then to make any sense. But I find interesting kind of the idea of going in and out of that grid a bit. And with I'm not quite sure which one of these I'm going to play yet, but with these things that were, I was calling it my disco project a couple of years ago, but it's not terribly disco, but in my head it was disco. In my head I was in spandex. It's all made in the grid, but then playing with the idea of, like, say if you make 16 bars of sound within the grid, and then you can then copy that 16 bars, but then chop into it somewhere and start to sort of pull it back onto itself. So something that's going take that from there and sort of pull it so the beats start to jar and clash against one another. And sometimes it sounds awful and sometimes it works. But I think it's the rules and laws of music, and particularly in the West, notated music, which obviously has its own grid itself, and for to notate something that has the kind of rhythms that can be made in computer music, it would be extraordinary, an extraordinarily complex thing to do. So I'm going to play one of these.
I thought you were going to say that, you know, part of the technique is to break the rules, but then you actually said it's to follow the rules some of the time and to play off them at other times, which is quite interesting. Perhaps more interesting perspective than just simply ignoring the rules.
Yeah, yeah. I really like
the rules.
Yeah, I like the rules and like the mechanics of music and of rhythm. I take sort of sensory pleasure in sort of form and structure and that kind of thing. But I think since we have the opportunity to, to see what can happen when those rules are kind of turned back on themselves, which is kind of what's possible with computer music, then we ought to be doing that, really.
Yeah.
Now I don't know which one I'm going to play with these. Let's try this one.
Might be worth saying, as we're playing them, it might be worth saving comments that you want to make about pieces until afterwards, and then also sharing with the rest of the group.
Somebody described this as Justin Bieber in a K-hole.
I never thought it would happen.
On the grid much more than I remembered. But it doesn't matter because it leads us neatly into disposable music, which is the and disposable art, which this this disco thing was the first. The first time I played with this idea, because I've given an awful lot of music away on the internet. And going back to the things I was saying many moons ago at the very beginning, about the abyss and about the way that that posting something on the internet and then it disappearing very quickly, unless you post it again and again and again and again, but then again it just disappears and into this big pit with everything else. So it led me to this idea of a sort of survival method for artists, is to use the digital environment and to use the internet and to use any equipment that they might have to make work that's generated very quickly, then put online very quickly, and then that disappears just as quickly. So to make art where you're accepting that it's going to disappear, rather than to make art for posterity, or because we're in this culture of instant disposability of pretty much everything anyway. So it seems to make sense if you're going to be an artist who operates on the internet to kind of play that game too and just throw out lots and lots of stuff and accept that it's going to disappear. But then what I've been doing based around the idea is trying to develop methods and formats where people can take material and have quick methods for making art that can then go on the internet and then disappear. One of which called popgasms, and a popgasm, the idea of one of those is you take a piece of you take a piece of pop music from any time, and then you take, chop out one phrase from it, and then put this one phrase on the grid, and then put them next to each other, and then take a few at a time, change the pitch of them. So that one goes, that one goes, that one goes, that one goes, and then take a drum loop from wherever you want to take a drum loop from. They're all over the place, and put that underneath these. And then once you've got all of these things, this one sound that's changing pitch here, and then this drum loop here, then you can start to do this thing that I was talking about, where you start to cut into the grid and start to pull the grid back on itself, so the rhythms and stuff start to change and become surprising. But theoretically, with this kind of practice, it takes only like 10 minutes to make a 4-minute piece. I'll play you a short video about the popgasm, and then we'll put one of them on. And if you think my beard's beautiful today, just wait till you see this.
gratification or disposable.
An out-of-date web link there. Another internet thing. I want to play one of the popgasms, or some of it, just to make it a bit clearer how it works. Here's the original song that the popular music. That doesn't sound like it. Yeah, this song. There's a popgasm called High Estates, which takes just one of those, but I think less than a whole fragment, and takes that, puts a drum beat underneath it, loops it, and puts the notes up and down. And we'll put a little bit of it on, not all of it, it's 6 minutes long. And good God, it's 2:30. Okay, a little bit. Leads us on to copyright questions and this kind of thing, because obviously it's a big issue now that obviously you're not supposed to use High Estate of Consciousness to make a track on the Free Music Archive that's a popgasm, because it's illegal to sample stuff that's owned by people. But what I've found, and from lots of conversations about this with people who also work with sound collage, is it seems, especially because of the music industry is such a big horrible thing, it seems perfectly justifiable to steal anything from culture. We're living in an age of total information overload, and it's, you know, to walk down a high street and go into any shops, you're completely surrounded by music. And again, this is an experience that's kind of unique to the last, I guess since the 1950s is when this sort of department store music thing started happening. Before, the whole notion of music as something to happen in the background only came about at the beginning of the 20th century through a composer called Eric Satie, who had the idea of making a kind of music called furniture music, which literally meant music that's like wallpaper that's on in the background. And when he first tried to present his furniture music, everybody was eating and talking, and as soon as the music started, of course, everybody stopped talking and turned around to listen to the music, and Satie was apparently running around tearing his hair out going, don't listen. But now we're so used to this idea of music being on in the background, almost to the fact that it's almost like an accessory to our, like a lifestyle accessory or something like that. And I think because we're so overloaded with music and advertising that we're not asking to look at or to listen to, I think it's perfectly ethically correct that we can take the whole world and play with it as we will, really, because that's also, it's the way that art and science and everything progresses through borrowing and to a certain extent theft. So I wanted to talk about the idea of the song. We were talking earlier on, about pop songs as being like this form of music that's become like the, not the benchmark, but kind of people's sort of standard way of listening to music is the pop song. And another area of what I do is kind of reinterpretations of songs, or for want of a better word, cover versions. and I've done a lot of them over the years, because what I find peculiar is the idea of the cover version. The idea, again, it's this idea of the progression of technology informing the way that we think about things. But prior to the recording industry, a song was something that would be sold on sheets of paper, or would be, you know, sung and passed on to somebody else. And much as the composer who wrote the song, owned the song to an extent because the composer wrote it, a song was a thing that was alive because everybody, you know, people would gather around the piano and play them themselves. And I think it's fine to record songs, but what I find strange is the idea that the recording, if somebody writes a song and then Beyoncé sings it, I find it strange culturally that the version that Beyoncé sings is considered like the ultimate incarnation of that song. So, because a song is I think of it as like, well, almost like the DNA of a recorded song. And I think that kind of DNA of the recorded song should be, should be accessible for transformation for all of us. Because again, it's something that's thrust on us all the time, and we can't help but remember them. So I think everything that's kind of thrust on us, that embeds in our memory that we didn't particularly ask for, you know, we should be able to own it ourselves. But also, I just think it's a real shame, this idea that, you know, a song as a thing, like the information of that song, once it's recorded by someone with a lot of money, is set in stone as an object forever. And if somebody else wants to make a recording of that song, then it's a derivative of it. It's a cover version. It's not another version of that song. It's a cover version of the original recording. I want to play you a cover version of something, but I'll see what there is. I might call out names and what have we got? Destiny's Child, anyone? Survivor, everybody know Survivor?
Of course you do.
Right then. Oh, it'll be right up to the top of that one. Ooh. Yeah. Right. I'll play Survivor and then I'll try and wrap up somehow. On a practical level, is that to sort of have an income as an artist, I think now it's necessary more than ever just to be an opportunist and just grab at every sort of possible strand, and to really just keep an open mind as to what anything creative can be, and how the different things can cross over with each other, and all the different ways that stories can be told, and all the different ways that one thing can have infinite meanings. And the last thing that I really feel strongly about is that really that it should all, I don't know, it feels important to me that art should be really like personal and almost like a private magic box that you throw out into the world that then disappears down the internet toilet. So I'm very glad that the last word was toilet, so I'm going to wrap up there. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ergo, for that talk. Really kind of rich variety of stuff, and hopefully it's been inspiring and thought-provoking for everybody.